It's time for another edition of On Your Money. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, February the 8th. Coming up, we welcome in financial planner Kevin McKinley, who is still celebrating the big Super Bowl win of the Green Bay Packers. And we'll talk a little bit about the financial implications of that Super Bowl win during this edition of On Your Money. Plus, Kevin has advice on really important things like how to save money on pizza. And we also will welcome your questions about your personal finances at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let me welcome our guest, Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC with offices in Eau Claire and Madison, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
And are you still celebrating that that big win?
What win was that?
Yeah, I know. I wasn't watching either. Actually, I wasn't watching.
I hadn't heard. What was there? Was there? Was there a victory? Did the
Chess
Club do well?
What happened? Exactly it. Those Green Bay Packers. The Titletown's going to welcome the Green Bay Packers home. Well, they came home yesterday, but a big celebration this afternoon. I think 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Lambeau Field will be full of adoring fans welcoming and cheering on their Green Bay Packers, the champions of Super Bowl 45. That was fun, wasn't it?
It was a blast. It was a great game. Good win. Two good teams with legions of fans scattered throughout the world. I don't think anyone could ask for much more other than if you were a Steelers fan.
Yeah, that's right. And we have one of those around here. Anyway, the Packers apparently may remain Super Bowl champions for quite a while, but not for the reasons you might think.
Well, no, and it's because there is a bit of a labor dispute between the owners and the players' union in the NFL, and the NFL has about $9 billion with a B dollars of revenue that comes in, and there's a question as how they're going to divvy that up. The current labor agreement expires on March 4th, which is a little over 3 weeks away. And if and when it does, and by all accounts it's about to, there is going to be technically no agreement, so there will be no NFL. The owners want a bigger share of the pie. They want lower rookie contracts, and they also want to move to an 18-game regular season instead of a 16-game season. The players who currently get, of that $9 billion, the owners get the first $1 billion, and then the players get about 59% of that remaining $8 billion of revenue for salaries. And they, of course, don't want to give that up. Plus, they're asking for better pension protection, better health insurance, all kinds of little things that would hopefully serve as bargaining chips in the worst case scenario and maybe make their lot in life a little better.
So there could be a lockout. And how could that affect our finances?
There are some surprising ways. The first one is that the Lambeau Stadium ticket revenue basically is about $46 million a year into that district for it. Plus, you've got all the other bars and restaurants and hotels that not only would get business, but also charge taxes upon the business that would be missed out if there were no games in the coming year. Also, the state income tax fund may suffer quite a bit. The Wall Street Journal just came out with a little bit on the editorial page, and I'm not sure about the accuracy of this, and not just because it was on the Wall Street Journal editorial page, but they calculated that Aaron Rodgers, just in 2009, made about $8.5 million in salary, and that he paid about $700,000 in state income taxes into the state of Wisconsin for it, and then typically, the way the jock tax works in professional sports, players who play in a certain area get paid to play in that particular game. So even visiting teams many times have to pay these taxes. And this was actually instituted on a broader basis after in 1991, the Chicago Bulls beat the Los Angeles Lakers for the NBA championship in Los Angeles. And on the way home, they landed at O'Hare Airport, and they were celebrating, and a few days later, the state of California sent them a bill for income taxes that they owed for earning money beating the Los Angeles Lakers in California.
I like that it's called a jock tax, but I didn't realize those jocks paid a lot of taxes in Wisconsin.
Yes, and technically, as I understand this anyway, it's not actually on the jock itself.
That's good. Is there any hope at all for a quick resolution of this?
There may be, and it's more so with really how the players are. The owners are going to lose probably $1 billion based on the lockout and how long it lasts, just because a lot of people won't re-up their season tickets right away while they wait to see if the dispute is resolved. The players are the ones who are the key to it and are probably going to be the ones who cave in on this, just because the average salary is about $2 million a year for an NFL player. Many of these players experience financial hardship when times are good and they are getting paid. The NFL Players Union sent out several memos over the last year to these players saying, look, save your money. Do not buy the new cars. Do not buy the big houses, because you may not be earning any income whatsoever for it. So it looks like they're probably going to come back to the table with their hat in hand. And quite frankly, you know, you've got billionaires arguing against millionaires, but the players have a lot more to lose because they have such short careers anyway.
Well, specifically, how could the lockout affect the Packers?
From a financial standpoint, probably not as badly. First of all, because the Packers have done very well financially in the past few years, always selling out. And then also because they've got a lot of ancillary revenue coming in from renting out the atrium and all the extras that they built up around there. It's not like 1923 when the team just about went bankrupt and wouldn't have existed really if they hadn't gone through that bankruptcy and been passed over to the nonprofit status for it. One of the other sources of revenue they have, by the way, is there's a little box on Wisconsin state income tax returns, which you can check off if you want some money to go to several different nonprofits, one of which is the Green Bay Packers. And in 2009's tax year, the Packers received almost $900,000 from state income taxpayers who wanted to boost their team a little bit. And I'm guessing that this year they'll probably get quite a bit more from exuberant fans. On the field, history says that they'll probably be unlikely to repeat, because most Super Bowl champions don't even win a playoff game the next year, much less win another Super Bowl. However, it is a very young team. They won the Super Bowl with several people injured, both during the season and in the last quarter of the game. And some of those people will be coming back. They don't have a huge number of free agents who should be leaving. And actually, the lockout may help them, because otherwise they are going to be starting practicing in July, which is 5 months away. And if they can get a little more rest compared to what a typical Super Bowl contender might, steady coach, steady quarterback, a lot of veterans coming back, they probably have as good a chance of any Super Bowl champion as repeating in the next year.
You betcha. We have a caller on who wants to talk a little bit about the Packers. David in Arena joins us. Hi, David.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning.
And good morning to your guest. I just wanted to ask, and you sort of answered it, or you mentioned it at least, the unique nature of the Packers is that they have many owners, not just one owner who is in it for the profit, like, well, notable figures, including an ex-president owned a professional baseball team. The Packers are a nonprofit, publicly owned entity, and so there's less, I would say, lust for profit generally in management. Now, when you talk about a players' strike, I think that most people in your listening audience who really think carefully about it would support the players, because except for the Packers, they're the only team in professional sports that is constructed the way they are. All the others are privately owned, for-profit entities, and they not only that, but they've gotten tax help to build huge stadiums, unlike Lambeau Field. And I think that I'm on the side of the players. I mean, I realize they make a lot more money than I do. But in this instance, it's the only vestige left of organized labor that seems to have some public interest. And so I'm with the players' union all the way on this.
All right. Thank you very much, David. But again, Kevin, that nonprofit status of the Packers and the fact that the Packers have are publicly owned or have many owners, that doesn't change things for this the labor management dispute going on, right?
Probably not. Mostly because it's really, even with the Packers and the system, it's actually in the charter of the NFL that that no nonprofit can come and purchase the team and own it from that standpoint. Now that could change, I guess, but I highly doubt that will happen. And the Packers, to be fair, the Packers do get a lot of tax revenue for constructing their stadium. Plus, Packers so-called owners. Who bought the $200 share certificate? Never have been so many people bought a share that is technically and so tangibly worthless that they've been so happy with in their lives is that certificate that they've issued so that stockholders can technically own part of the team, but really get no dividend for it, and it's very difficult to sell, and most of those people would never do it.
Yeah, so should my husband and I make plans to go to that season opener of Chicago versus Green Bay?
Sure. You can always cancel them, get a non-refundable ticket. You might get better tickets whatsoever. And by the way, for people who are interested, there was a very good New Yorker article a few weeks ago on the unique ownership structure of the Packers. And we'll put a link up to that on our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today. Plus, somebody took all of the highlights of the Super Bowl and boiled it down to 53 seconds. So if you missed the game, or more likely you just want to relive the memories once again, we'll link to that video at onyourmoney.com as well later on today.
Sounds good. Kevin McKinley, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through the broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with your own financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. And it is time for the On Your Money email box. And Kevin, Beverly says she and her husband are discussing buying long-term care insurance. And she wants to know about tax deductions associated with long-term care expenses and whether you have any rules of thumb that you can offer.
Right. Well, long-term care is not an enjoyable topic to discuss, especially with spouses. It's probably more enjoyable to discuss, rather than buying life insurance on each other, because that can create a whole new host of stresses and arguments and worries in a couple. So we'll be covering this more in depth in the future. But right now, the rules of thumb, Beverly, are that it used to be that if you had between $100,000 and $1 million in liquid assets, you should look at buying long-term care insurance. If you had less than that amount, you probably couldn't afford the premiums. And if you had more than that amount, you could probably self-insure and pay as you go. In part because of the low interest rate environment right now, that number has been bumped up to about $200,000 to $2 million. So the numbers are between that. If you have at least $200,000 in liquid assets and less than $2 million, you probably should look at long-term care insurance. The other rule of thumb is that the monthly premium you pay for that insurance typically buys you 1 day's worth of long-term care.
Wow.
So if you are going to look to get, say, $6,000 of coverage, usually for 3 or 4 years, and $6,000 per month, that you divide that by 30, and that comes out to about $200 per month, which, again, should buy you about $200 per day of coverage.
I get it. Okay. So how can buyers save money on premiums?
Well, they should generally look at a long elimination period, which is kind of like a deductible for another type of insurance policy. It means you'd pay cash for the first 3 or 6 months or more of the coverage, and then the insurance would kick in later on. And again, because you're probably going to have some cash on hand or Social Security payments coming in, 6 months of coverage out of pocket is not too bad for many people who do get into this situation. You can also get a substantial discount with many companies if you are a married couple and you purchase policies for each other's lives and long-term care like Beverly and her husband are looking to do. And also there are partnership policies, which we'll be getting into more, again, in depth later on. But partnership policies basically allow you to protect a lot of assets before qualifying for Medicaid, equal to the amount basically of what the insurance policy is willing to pay out.
Are there any tax breaks available for long-term care expenses?
Yeah, depending on the type of expenses, your age, and your income bracket, the premiums are generally deductible. But what they do is they slide the premiums into a qualifying medical expense bucket. And if your medical expenses exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, all of those medical expenses, then any amount over that becomes tax deductible. And the long-term care premiums fit into that. And again, it slides. Typically, a couple in their 60s, if they're paying $200 to $300 per month, that can qualify as a potentially deductible medical expense.
And you say we're going to be covering more on this and related topics in the coming months?
Right. We're going to be going over how to find a good policy, some of the facts and figures behind the Medicaid system and qualifying for public assistance. Also, some of the new products that are coming out that might be more attractive to people who don't want to just pay and pay and pay for months on end and then pass away and never use the insurance. And also some non-traditional ways of paying for the care that people are going to need.
This might seem like a really simple question, but when should one consider buying long-term care insurance? A robust 50-year-old radio host doesn't need this, does she? Just wondering.
Of all the positive adjectives which I might use to describe you,
I'm robust.
Robust would not be one I would choose, mostly out of fear of a harassment lawsuit,
okay.
But that wouldn't be the one that I would choose. I have many, many, many.
I don't know why
nice
it just came to mind, but it did. Yeah.
Hale, hearty, healthy. You need to buy it when you don't need it and when you're laying awake at night worrying about it. A lot of times what triggers this is not so much people say, you know, we have the money and it's a time in our life when we should be doing this. Really is people witness up close what can happen to a loved one, usually an older parent. And long-term care insurance really needs to be thought of not so much as nursing home insurance, but dementia and Alzheimer's care, because that's the type of thing where the body can last a very, very long time while the brain is not able to function and watch out for yourself. So buy it when you can afford it and when you're scared enough into getting it. It's, again, it's one of those insurances that's better to have and not need than need and not have.
To your questions for Kevin McKinley in just a moment. 1-800-642-1234, and we have a rare open line for you if you have a money matter on your mind this morning or a question about investing or managing your money. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Coming up on Your Money, we'll talk about how big snowstorms can affect our financial health. And Kevin has tips on how to save money on pizza. But now time for your question at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Heather in Menominee Falls is with us. Hello, Heather.
Hi, how are you?
Very good.
Good. I am 24 years old. I graduated from college a couple of years ago, and I'm looking to buy a house. I was just wondering how much money I should have in savings in addition to my down payment.
Kevin.
Before you're able to buy a house, you mean?
Yeah. Like, I have enough right now for the down payment on a house in the price range that I want. But I'm just wondering how much additional savings.
Yeah, so she doesn't have that, emergency fund. How important is that to have, or how big should that be before she buys a house?
Sure, yeah. Let's back up a second. Heather, are you gainfully employed?
I am, yeah. I'm an engineer.
Okay. Like the train driving kind? Like, woo, woo.
No, they still haven't let They still haven't let me drive the train. I don't know what that's about.
Well, you're young. You'll get your chance. Okay, good for you. And you like the area in which you're living, I take it?
Yeah, I do. And I'm not currently paying rent. I'm actually living at home.
Oh, okay.
So I've just had the opportunity to just save up.
Sure. You could just wait out your parents. I mean, you know, take it over at the lawyer's office, really, anything else. No, good for you, Heather. You sound like you're well on your way to a nice start in life. Are you buying a home just because it would feel nice to buy a home, or because you're worried about, gosh, I don't want to move into an apartment and lose out on rent?
I guess a little bit of both. I'm buying a home. I feel like I'm ready to have my own space. I had my own space in college, and then I came back. I don't really want to pay rent. I feel like a home is a good investment now, and I really want to be kind of in the neighborhood that I grew up in, but I don't want to be right under my parents' roof.
You want to be in the home you grew up in.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And actually, it's a very, it's a high compliment to both you and your parents that mm-hmm. you do even, I mean, some kids say, yeah, I just don't want to, you know, I'm looking for a place to live, and I just don't want to live in the same hemisphere I grew up in. That's all I'm trying to my criteria. Okay, well, a couple things. First of all, don't look upon this as an investment. And one of the big mistakes that many people made over the last decade or so was looking upon their house as an investment and a way of making money, and we're just paying rent and we're not building up any equity. Don't look upon a home as a source of financial gain. It'd be neat if it worked out that way, but it's not a good way to judge it. The way to judge it is, do I like the home? Am I comfortable in the neighborhood? And do I have the money to not only pay the mortgage, but pay the expenses? And you've knocked those things out of the park.
Sure.
I'd like you to pay down as little as the lender allows. Hopefully that's 20%, so you don't have to pay private mortgage insurance. But if the lender will let you get by with even less than that, I would do it. And the reason being is it's better to keep the cash on hand and not have it stuck into the home, so that if something comes up that you need to fix or want to fix, or, knock on wood, you lose your job and you know, you need to go through your savings to keep your mortgage payment and keep your home until you find a new job. So if you had... You know, and especially for an engineering job, engineers generally very much in demand. However, the better the job is, the longer it takes to find a new one if you lose it, and especially if you lose it by layoffs or getting fired rather than by quitting on your own volition. So I'd like you to have at least 6 months of living expenses set aside in cash, and it would actually be better if you had a whole year's worth set aside. Now, you might be able to get that by opening up a home equity line of credit after you get the mortgage, but generally I'd prefer that you put no more than 20% down, and again, 10% down of the home's price if you can stomach the private mortgage insurance that the lender might charge.
Okay, and would you count a 401k as a liquid asset?
Not particularly. It's a liquid asset where you say, hey, we haven't eaten in 3 days. Where should we get some money? But not a liquid asset as a safety net for living expenses, because when you're saving in that 401k, if you need to take it out to live off of it, you're going to pay a ton in taxes and penalties on it. You're probably going to give up about 30 to 40% of it. So it can whittle away really quickly, and if that's your only savings, then you're down to nothing in the matter of months.
Okay, and I had also considered, because there is a house that I kind of have my eye on, considered reducing my contribution to my 401k so I can build mm-hmm. up my savings faster. Is that, I mean, at my age, I don't think it would matter too much, but...
Yeah, it probably doesn't, and especially you're probably in the 25% federal tax bracket. That's line 43 on your 1040, and it's $34,500 for a single person in 2011. I would actually, here's what I tell you to do, Heather, is I would put enough money into the 401k to get any match from your employer, then use a Roth IRA after that. You can put in up to $5,000 per year, and that can be your savings, because as Joy and both the other regular listeners to this show know, you can pull the contribution portion of a Roth IRA back out at any time for any reason whatsoever with no taxes or penalties. So that can kind of save as your ersatz savings account, but also it could be there for retirement later on.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much for calling, Heather, and best of luck to you. I'm really impressed. Kevin, could you imagine buying a house when you're 24 years old?
Yeah, Heather sounds it. I mean, there are all kinds of things in life that may confront Heather from a negative standpoint, but none of those things, you can't prepare for any of those things or guard against them. She sounds like one of those people, and by doing this for 20-some years, I've run into them who are 40 years older than Heather, and they really have a great life because they enjoy what they do generally. They kind of spend their money on things they like, but they don't just spend it frivolously, and she really sounds like she's got a good head on her shoulders.
Thanks a lot, Heather. Moving now to Earl in Medford. Hello, Earl.
Good morning. Kevin, my dream is that I will wind up in the nursing home in the room next to you, and then we can talk about all this in our golden years.
Well, that is good, Earl.
I'm skewing my long-term insurance for that goal. But I wanted to ask about long-term insurance. We didn't select the inflation-proof one because it was much more expensive. And say I live 20 more years or so, am I going to be, and I don't have the exact amount, what the coverage is, but will inflation in 20 years really eat into my long-term care insurance?
That's a good question. There is, many of these policies do have an inflation adjuster to the coverage. But again, you're losing out on money that you pay in the form of higher premiums. And you collect Social Security, correct, Earl?
I'm sorry, Earl, we missed that. Do you collect Social Security?
Yes, I do. I collect it.
Okay. You're a collector. The the Social Security has a function in it that, you know, will bump up for the CPI, whether it will bump up at the same rate as long-term care expenses or what a policy might provide, that's another story. But your checks from your Social Security, which you will still receive while you're in the nursing home or whatever, will go up commensurate with inflation, or at least as it is according to the CPI. And the thing to look at with long-term care is not it's not a be-all end-all of paying for long-term care expenses to buy a long-term care insurance policy. It's just one more component to kind of fill in the gaps between public assistance, savings, Social Security, home equity, and then this insurance policy. So when people say, well, I want the Cadillac policies, you might pay $500 a month for that for 30 years. And then if you die in the way that most people want to, which is in your own bed and quickly and painlessly, you know, the insurance company will put a statue of you up in their lobby saying, Earl paid us several hundred thousand dollars and never asked a thing of us.
Just briefly, too, if you do have to go on Medicaid, can the spouse stay in the house? I've heard that the spouse can't stay in the house even though if you're on Medicaid.
Yeah, it depends on the value of the house. The house does not, in Wisconsin, does not have a clear track that, you know, you can just take $1 million, go buy $1 million house, the house stays in the spouse's name, and then you qualify for medical assistance. Let's get this straight, people. We have, 70 million baby boomers who are going to live to 90 on average, probably, and public assistance is certainly an option. You do not want to try to get the care that only public assistance provides. First of all, it puts way too much stress on the system. Second of all, it's no different than other types of public assistance. It's a bare basic, and people who care for people in nursing homes and assisted living, they do, I mean, God's work. It's just incredible the amount of stress and importance that those people provide. They're vastly underpaid, and it's very difficult to just say, well, I'm just going to give all my money away and wait for the government to kick in. You and your family probably won't enjoy that level of care as much as some people might think.
Earl, thanks very much for the call, and good luck to you. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner. He joins us just about every Tuesday for information and advice on your money. We have an open line for you if you have a question about your personal finances, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It's time now for our Smart Assets portion of the program. And Kevin, I know that recent snowstorm, that big blizzard in southern Wisconsin last week had a very negative effect on my my back and my shoulder, shoveling a couple, 3-4 feet of snow. But you say it also might have a negative effect on my wealth?
Yeah, we'll get to the health, but let's start with the wealth portion. The insurance industry just released a press release a few days ago that said that after hurricanes and tornadoes, snow is the biggest financial cause of payoff for homeowners insurance. And the real big problem comes from dangers to the roof, because the snow gets overloaded on top, then it starts to melt, and the ice wends its way underneath the roof, seeps in, freezes again, melts, freezes, melts, freezes, and you get water damage. So you definitely want to get the snow off your roof if possible. There's a rake at northerntool.com that's about $45. That's a Minnesota company. I don't know of any Wisconsin companies that manufacture it, but those are probably gone by now. But again, because it's a fairly dangerous operation, yes, the tool is cheap, but actually doing it can hurt your health even more. So if you can find somebody who is willing to do it for you, definitely pay them to get the snow off your roof.
Yeah, we had to pay someone to get the snow off our roof a couple of years ago, and then we invested in a roof rake, and my husband was busy doing that while I was shoveling the driveway. but how about the snow that's on our sidewalks and driveways? Is that any cheaper to deal with than the snow on the roof?
That seems easier because it's, you know, below eye level. But the American Journal of Emergency Medicine just released a study where they said on average every year 11,500 people go to the emergency room for injuries that they incur while trying to just shovel the walks or the driveways. This can be slipping and falling, a lot of back strains and tissue damage, but there were several amputations of those tips of the fingers where, you know, people with advanced degrees and well-paying jobs think that it's okay to stick your hand into the churning blades of the snowblower to try to clear it out rather than use a stick or something. So it can be a very dangerous operation. Now, if you are going to get a snowblower, it's a good time to look at one if you can find one in the stores. But generally, late February, early March, if there's one around, it's very heavily discounted snowblowers. However, one way to look at this is a really good snowblower is about $1,000. And if you use that 10 times a year for 10 years, let's say, that's, you know, $10-$20 per pop. And then plus all the gas, plus the energy to do it, plus you have to have it maintained during the off years and everything. And so for my money, I would prefer that you just hire someone to actually get the snow out of your driveways and sidewalks, pay a little bit of money to them. You're nice, safe, and warm with your cocoa or brandy or tea or whatever, and watching them. And those people get to earn money doing what they want to do for a living.
Do you think I can find someone to do that at 2 in the morning?
Actually, probably the best way to find a good person to do that is if you live in a neighborhood and you see someone with a very nicely plowed walk when you wake up in the morning to go to work or wherever, go to the neighbor and say, hey, who does it? Because they do a good job and it looks like they come really early. Not only can you get a reference from a neighbor, someone you know and trust, but also you might be able to get a discount for the two of you because the snowplow person says, good, I get to do two or three driveways without having to travel all over town. Another good way to find a person is to look into the Yellow Pages, find a company in your area that actually sells the hydraulic plows that go on the front of pickup trucks or SUVs that do this, and say, hey, who would you recommend to do this? Because they know who's, you know, not only buying lots of plows, but getting them repaired a lot because they're very busy. And so that's another good way to try to find someone to do it. I don't know. I guess in terms of doing it yourself, hiring kids to do it, it's probably a good idea, but that's a little bit more difficult of a proposition than just giving someone $40 or $50.
Right, and that's a good idea. My neighbor has a snow removal service and wouldn't take much just to, you know, do one more house. But speaking of kids today don't shovel, do they, or do they?
My kids shovel.
Do they?
I wonder what else. Why else do people have children other than to perform menial tasks?
So that's your snow removal service, okay?
Absolutely. My lawn mowing, my garbage hauling. I mean, they're getting free room and board the way I see it, plus possible college tuition. I think it's a great trade-off here. Snow blowing and removal is not bad for a kid, but it's a pretty narrow window between a kid who lives at home, unlike Heather, and is still old enough to do this. Plus, unlike you know, mowing lawns in the neighborhood. If it rains, you can usually mow the lawn the next day, but people want their snow removed immediately. And so you might have find your 13-year-old up at 2 o'clock in the morning, like you say, trying to get all the snow out of there. If you do have the kid remove your snow, you might want to look at having the kid go around to the other neighbors and say, hey, if I'm going to be shoveling my driveway, I might as well do yours too. And you can use the money that the kid gets paid as a contribution to a Roth IRA for him or her.
Sounds good. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And Kevin, today you wanted to talk about pizza and ways that we can enjoy our slice and save money too.
Yes, and I'd like to thank our producer, Rob Ferret, for going into his ethnic music file for to always get the one song that represents that specific type of food.
That made me think of pizza, didn't it?
Well, I wonder if there actually is, if there's just one album of ethnic songs, you know, where there's 30 or 40 different things where you know right away that this is what we're going to
discuss.
Pizza
song.
Yeah. That's right. Pizza is actually a $30 billion business in America, meaning that households on average pay about $6 or $7 per week for pizza. The Super Bowl is actually the fifth biggest day for pizza in America. Papa John's and Domino's both thought they would sell about 1 million pizzas each on this past Sunday. And the other big days are Halloween, New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, Thanksgiving Day Eve as well. So what's happening with pizza, though, is that when you go to the grocery store and you see the cost of all of the food that you buy on a weekly basis going up, that's affecting pizza manufacturers, and it's going to affect you fairly soon if and when you go to try to buy pizza. Now, we're not talking about the individually owned places that really create a great meal. We're talking more about, you know, the chains, frozen pizza, and then making it at home. But there are some definite ways that you can go about saving what you spend on pizza.
There's a way we can save with the chains?
Actually, the chains are probably the easiest way to save, just because there's a price war going on right now between the larger ones. And you know, you can argue about the taste and quality, but you can't argue that for $6 for a large pizza, if you went out to buy the ingredients at the grocery store and make it yourself, you'd probably end up spending more than $6 for it. But you definitely, Saturday is obviously the biggest day for pizza ordering. That's the day that you're not going to get any discounts unless you have a coupon. You want to check to see if there's some specials on Mondays and Tuesdays. You can get a very good deal by eating pizza on Monday and Tuesday instead of eating it on Saturday night for it. Also, go to the chain's website and register. Yes, you have to give them your email, but they will send you some coupons, usually for registering. Plus, you'll hear about the deals first and foremost, and they might have access to some other savings that you might get otherwise. But always ask, you know, whenever they call you up and or you call the pizza place and you say hi and they go, welcome to Battaglio's or whatever, would you like to try some of our chicken hot wings? That's probably not the thing that you want to buy. What you want to look at is say, do you have any other specials on right now? And then they'll tell you what's going on.
Then what about the frozen pizzas at the supermarket? Are they generally a good deal?
Yeah, the similar conditions apply. There are price wars going on there too, but do not buy a frozen pizza at list price, because all that means is that the delivery person hasn't been in to put the sale on. You only want to buy these things when they're on sale. Stock up, load up your cart, and then hopefully you've got a freezer big enough to hold all of them, and then they'll be immediately accessible. And again, the frozen pizza, you know, if you buy it, you'll find actually the prices when they're not on sale are as much as the sale prices of some of the chains selling. So you do only want to buy them on sale, put them in the freezer and wait for later. But there are some tremendous savings going on if you keep your eyes open.
You know, I've made my own pizzas every once in a while with an already made crust, and so it wasn't that hard. But I'm not sure it was, I think it probably cost me quite a bit of money. What about that?
Yeah, those are fairly expensive too. So if you are going to do it, you really want to make it special in the summertime, especially making your own dough, putting it on the grill. And there's 100 videos online on how to actually build your own brick pizza oven wow. in the backyard. In the winter, if you want to do it yourself, obviously, you know, a little flour. You can make your own dough. You can also, many people buy packaged bread dough and just spread that out. And like you said, you can use that pre-made crust. But even when I've done that in the past, I found that the pre-made crust is $4 or $5. It's almost what the cost of the pizza
right.
is of itself. We had an abundance of tomato and basil that we grew last summer. And so we hit on a very inexpensive recipe that is not as good as, you know, dining in a restaurant that with a pizza oven that can do this the right way, but it's very inexpensive. What you do is you take a regular large tortilla and put it under the broiler just for a few seconds, flip it over, do it again. That kind of crisps it up a little bit. And then slice a tomato, put it on top of that. Take some mozzarella cheese and sprinkle shredded mozzarella cheese and put it on top of that. Slide it back under the broiler for a few minutes. Pull it back out and chop up some fresh basil on that. And I think I figured out that because we were growing our own tomato and basil at that time, that worked out to be a good meal for two people. And it was about 42 cents a serving is what I figured out.
You know what? And that sounds tasty. And it actually sounds like it's not too bad for the waistline, if you know what I mean. That sounds really
no,
good.
No, it isn't at all. And I did the calorie count and everything for it. And it actually wasn't too bad. But boy, it is really good. And pulling it fresh out of the oven like that with the basil, really, it really pops. Again, it's not going to be as good as something you get for someone who has a wood-fired brick oven in a restaurant. But it's going to be a lot less expensive.
Yeah, it'll do. Let's take some calls for Kevin McKinley while we still have some time here during this edition of On Your Money. And our next caller is Sandy in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Sandy.
Good morning, and thank you so much for this great show. I never miss it. My question is, I recently retired. I have a retirement annuity, and I don't intend to do anything with it except to continue to allow it to supplement my Social Security. However, I'm very curious. There have been so many commercials on television telling people with structured settlements and annuities that they should call this company and get their money back, you know, and say it's your money, use it when you need it. What is that all about? Because I don't remember until the last couple of months ever seeing commercials like that. And what do you have any idea, Kevin, what a company takes of a person's money when they decide to go in that direction?
Yes. How long ago did you retire, Sandy?
Just a couple of months ago.
Well, ironically enough, here's why you're seeing more of those commercials, Sandy. You've got all this extra free time on your hands, so you're watching television shows that you normally would not waste time watching.
That's
and I do
true.
This. Here's what I do. A lot of times I've caught myself watching a show that I enjoy, and I'm not proud of the quality of the show. It's not Masterpiece Theater or whatever, mm-hmm. but I enjoy the show, whatever. And then all of a sudden a commercial comes on, like the structured products or tax debt settlement or, you know, adult diapers or something. I say, wait a minute, do I really want to be in this target audience for this particular
product? Well, I am.
And if I, right, exactly. So I tend to just put it on the DVR. That way I can at least fast forward through the commercials and it's a little less,
same.
I feel a little less guilty about it. But yeah, I get what you're saying. Structured settlements, typically what they do to people is they say, all right, here's the present value of your annuity based on how long it's likely to last and the amount of money that is going to come in. And they figure out a dollar value that it's worth today. And they probably offer you about 40 to 50 cents on that dollar value.
Wow.
And it's one of those things, like a lot of those commercials, it's designed to attract very desperate people rather than people who are making a shrewd decision. Now, if someone is getting an annuity, it's their only source of income and they just cannot, find any other source of money in an emergency, then they are, by definition, desperate and they have to go with these. It's a good question, but no, it's something that I would definitely shy away from. You'll hardly ever get a good deal from a structured settlement like that.
It's interesting. I was just curious, but it sounds like they take quite a chunk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd guess it's half of the present value, which is probably only a few years' worth of the checks. And so if you outlive that amount, it's better off to just keep taking the checks. Again, unless you run into an emergency, if that's your only source of money, that's your only source of money. But otherwise, no, I'd shy away from it.
Thank you, Sandy, for the call. Andrea in Johnson Creek is with us now. Hi, Andrea.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Despite having breakfast, I'm hungry for pizza now.
Yeah, me too.
I thought I'd ask you some questions about regular and traditional and Roth IRA CDs. My aunt has a combination of these at very low interest rates. So we're talking about 0.4 to maybe 1.5%. A lot of them are stair-stepped, 6 months to 18 months. She's 77, but she has not been taking her minimum required distributions. And the task of managing her money has fallen to me. I'm debating whether I should try to wait it out and take the minimum distributions in a smart way and try to liquidate some of these, or do I take the easy route and liquidate everything, because these are amongst about a half a dozen banks, and consolidate them into one bank that I could manage maybe online and get her into some other investments that have a higher interest rate.
Sure. Great questions, and there's some good opportunities in there for both you and your aunt, but there's also a big red flag, and that is, you said, Andrea, that she has not taken any of her required minimum distributions out?
She has not. In fact, banks that have given her notice and actually sent her checks have then said, oops, these checks are expired. So, I mean, we have other issues, obviously.
Right. Yep, but that's a big one. And we talked about long-term care for, you know, the body, mind, soul, and spirit. There's going to be a new industry, and it's what Andrea is going through and probably wishes she could pay someone else to do, and that's long-term care for someone's financial situation.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, as I understand what Andrea has told me, technically the IRS requires minimum distributions from retirement accounts by April 1st of the year after turning 70 and a half in most cases. And if that money's not taken out, there's a 50% excise tax imposed on the money that should have been taken out and wasn't. So you're going to need to get a CPA, Andrea. You're going to probably need a tax lawyer, too, to figure out not only what you owe, but how to arrange it so the IRS is satisfied. Because someone's going to end up paying that money sooner or later. It's just a question of when the IRS finds out about it. Now, back to the what should be done with the money. I love the idea of putting it all at one institution, if it's as long as it's insured, just for simplicity's sake. But don't go shying away into other investments trying to get 1 or 2% extra yield. Your aunt's story is not going to be told by missing out on 1 or 2% yield. It's going to be told by not losing 20 or 30%, which can happen if you've stray too far away from safe investments. So here's what I would do. Go to one institution, get them all lined up there, and then go out as long as you possibly can on the CDs, as long as there is only a minimal substantial penalty for early withdrawal. That way, she gets a higher rate on her CDs, but if interest rates rise or she needs the money, she can pull it out, pay a very small penalty, and do either spend the money or take it somewhere else and get a higher rate for it. But yes, the RMD thing is the thing that I'm most concerned about, not trying to earn a higher yield.
Andrea, thank you so much for the call, and good luck. What a wonderful niece you are to help your aunt. We're out of time almost, Kevin, but time for the website of the week.
SaferProducts.gov is, if you're buying a used snow blower or snowmobile or lawnmower or whatever, you can find out if there has been a recall on that item and any dangers you should watch out for. SaferProducts.gov, and we'll have that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And please leave us with four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Thanks to Rob Ferret for producing the hour. Thanks to Chris Molina for on-air production. And thank you for listening. Stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.